BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Thank you for listening in again. I'm Kirsty Oswald, an actress with a wild side. I have been surrounded by bird enthusiasts my whole life, but my own knowledge is seriously below par, so I set myself the challenge to learn more about them.
With its russet cap, white cheeks and smarter appearance, the tree sparrow looks like a freshly scrubbed house sparrow. Unlike house sparrows, whose sexes look very different, the male and female tree sparrows are identical. Tree sparrows prefer a home in the country to urban living, and the way that we manage farmland has reduced their numbers considerably by depriving them of nest sites in old and hollow trees and reducing the supply of insects for the young in summer and grain and other seeds in winter. Although tree sparrow numbers are falling in the UK, they're widespread across Europe and Asia and were once considered a serious pest in the Far East. In China in the 1950s, the birds were accused of competing with people for grain and were proclaimed an enemy of the state. Citizens were mobilised to march around banging drums, blowing whistles and setting off firecrackers to prevent the birds from landing, causing them to die of exhaustion. 3 million people took part, and it's thought that tens of millions of birds perished. But amazingly, by the 1980s, the population had bounced back. Bringing them back in the UK is a different challenge. But providing tree sparrows with nest boxes is a very good start.
The Tree Sparrow with Martin Hughes Games. The person who inspired my aptitude for all things nature was my uncle, Chris Wilson. He used to say, "Birds are my passion, wildlife my nature." My brother and I used to sit on the roof of his Jeep, going across the slobs, which are the marshlands in Wexford, to look for ruddy darters, or at night, wrapped in my dad's oversized spleeces, listening quietly with the back detector for their echolocation on the lake, or listening in fear for the dreaded banshee, which was, of course, the beautiful barn owl. To tell us more about the haunting and magical barn owl, here's Miranda Krestovnikov.
There's no doubt that the snoring of a brood of young barn owls can be a hair-raising sound as you pass an old ruin or hollow tree at night. The screech of an owl was once an ill omen, as Shakespeare records in Lady Macbeth's speech. Hark! Peace! It was the owl that shrieked, the fatal bellman which gives the sternest good night. Alfred Lord Tennyson was more reflective. Alone and warming his five wits, the white owl in the belfry sits, he wrote, referring to the barn owl's supposed wisdom and love of old buildings. At this time of year, most are not alone, but are rearing their broods of gawky chicks. Barn owls are mainly nocturnal hunters. They're ghostly creatures with rounded wings and a large head, which acts as a reflector, funnelling the slightest sound from their prey towards their large ear openings. Using their remarkable hearing, they can pinpoint and catch a mouse in pitch darkness. They will use nest boxes, and in areas where their habitat is suitable, our reward is the unforgettable sight of a barn owl fanning like a huge moth over the meadows at dusk.
My inspiration was my uncle, Chris. Unfortunately, he passed away 2 years ago now, but he's the reason I love nature so much. He worked as an environmentalist consultant and warden at the Wexford Wildfowl Reserve in Ireland. I used to love doing the bird ringing with him and going out on our wildlife walks on the slobs conducting dragonfly and butterfly surveys. My passion for wildlife started when I was very young, and I love how you can never stop learning more about it. But my detailed knowledge is only very small, and I think that can put people off, particularly with bird watching, as it's so hard to start unless you're with someone that knows what they're looking at. It's easy to go to the wetland centres and feel intimidated or in the way, but birdwatchers there are always happy to share with you what they've spotted. We all have to start somewhere, and the RSPB centres and community are very supportive of that. There's no judgement or silly questions when it comes to nature, and we are never too old to learn more.
The Autumn Song of the Robin is the soundtrack to shortening days, gathering mists and ripening fruit. Robins sing in spring too, but their song in autumn is different. It may sound wistful to us, but for the robin it has a clear purpose: to defend the winter territories which male and female robins establish separately after they've molted. Both sexes begin singing their autumn song in late summer, sometimes as early as the end of July. It's unusual behaviour for a British bird because relatively few of our species hold winter territories, and even fewer have females which sing. Robins live almost anywhere. In his classic study, The Life of the Robin, ornithologist David Lack describes the woodlands, parks and hedgerows of England parcelled out into a series of small holdings, each the territory of a robin. They're famously feisty birds and defend their territories vigorously, attacking intruders in a flurry of wings and claws. Robins from Northern Europe also arrive to spend the winter here, which means that if you're a resident robin, singing and defending your territory is more important than ever.
There is something comforting about a visit from a robin. They remind me of my mum, and sometimes I think, is it her coming to say hello? Or am I projecting a personality onto something that just wants to eat the worms I've dug up? It makes sense that we are reminded of loved ones in nature as we search for answers in grief. Like the changing of the seasons, it constantly reminds us that life goes on. Whether the robin is a messenger from the spirit world or not, I'm grateful to have the inquisitive and charming visitor either way. What I admire most about people that love wildlife and nature is this almost peaceful acknowledgement of the circle of life. When my uncle knew he was going to die, he was so accepting. "It sucks," he says, "but it's only natural." As far as he was concerned, he was to return back to where he came from. His ashes were spread with the change of season, and with it wintering and the arrival of thousands of geese on the wetlands. Sitting at home now, I have a sketch by a close friend of my uncle's, an artist, Don Conroy. It's a bird that encompasses everything I love: wildlife, water, and astonishing eyebrows. I often used to see him in those wetlands in Ireland, and now I see him waiting patiently on the banks of the Thames, each time my fiancé and I arguing over whether this one's real or not. Have you guessed it? It's the grey heron, and here's the brilliant Fife Dangerfield to tell us more about it.
I love it whenever you get to somewhere where you can't see any evidence of the era in which you're living. It's like, I remember I had this amazing holiday in a place called Loch Inver, right up the top northwest of Scotland. And you get to places there where you just can't see even a telegraph line in sight. There's no evidence that you're in the 21st century. And I think with certain birds, you really, like, I think the heron just have this prehistoric sort of look about them. I mean, the heron especially, it almost looks like a dinosaur. And even the noise it makes when it flies, just this kind of, it's just so sort of like guttural. And it almost doesn't seem like a bird, because it's got these huge legs and this massive sort of beak. And like, it does almost seem like some, again, like a mutated dinosaur or something. There's something about bird watching and zoning into another species that you know that people hundreds of years ago were seeing the same species and so on, and that makes you aware of your own insignificance, which I find quite comforting. It's one of those things that you can either find scary or the opposite. It's a great leveller.
Uncle Chris's inspiration was his great-uncle, Edward Wilson, who was most famously chief of scientific staff on the Terra Nova expedition to the Antarctic. That team, although making it to the South Pole, never made it home, but what did survive was the wonderful legacy of research paintings and drawings of the intriguing new wildlife on Edward's part, and generations of inspired naturalists. I remember seeing Captain Scott's last letter to his wife, where he wrote, "Make the boy interested in natural history if you can. It's better than games." He was talking about his son, whom he never saw again. I wonder if I had only one piece of advice I was given by my parent, I might be more likely to listen to it. Peter Scott obviously did. As a result of this connection, as well as publishing Edward Wilson's notebooks and drawings, my Uncle Chris did over 10 tours to the Antarctic himself, lecturing about the wildlife on the ships. I remember seeing photos of his first trip on an old slide projector and being amazed at the striking snow petrel. Its coal black eyes and beak are the only thing you can see passing in front of an ice sheet. Here's Liz Bonin with the snow petrel.
On a wind-blasted Antarctic iceberg, small white hummocks sprout beaks to bicker and flirt with each other. These are snow petrels, one of the hardiest bird species in the world. Few bird species breed in the Antarctic, and fewer still are so intimately bound to its environment of snow and ice, where temperatures can plummet to minus 40 degrees Celsius and below. It's a pure white bird, apart from its black bill, eyes and feet. Returning to their breeding areas from October, the nest is a skimpy affair, nothing more than a pebble-lined scrape in a hollow or rocky crevice, where the parents rear their single chick on a diet of waxy stomach oil and carrion. For a bird of such purity, the snow petrel has a ghoulish diet. It feeds at sea on krill, squid or small fish, but will also forage at whale and seal carcasses. Although it breeds on islands such as South Georgia, which are north of the summer pack ice, the snow petrel's true home is among snow and ice, and it's even been seen at the South Pole.
No matter how old or young we are, wildlife connects us, inspires us, and fascinates us. You can never stop learning more about it, nor should we. I'm so glad I chose to do this challenge and stop judging myself on what I should know. From the famous black giraffe duck to the incredibly rare long-tailed tit, get excited, get out there and get learning. Ask all the silly questions. You'll be surprised how quickly you'll become the person that answers them. Thank you for listening to Tweet of the Week. You've just heard Martin Hughes Games on the Tree Sparrow, Miranda Krestovnikov on the Barn Owl, Brett Westwood on the Robin, Fife Dangerfield on the Grey Heron, and Liz Bonin on the Snow Petrel.